So Lisa, it's so nice to have you here. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you. My pleasure to be here.
We worked together a long time ago on, I think it was Three Amigos and Spies Like Us.
Yes.
Good old days when they made a lot of comedies. But you're working on an awesome film. You're working on Peter Pan and Wendy for Disney, and that's very exciting. But what I want to start out by asking you is, what sparked your interest in becoming a film editor?
The editing was a byproduct of just being introduced when I was in college for the first time as to what people did behind the scenes. I was spending my junior year abroad in New York, and my brother-in-law was going to NYU Film School, and he used my apartment as a location. And it was the first time I ever saw what people actually did. So that was in college, and I was like, okay, I think I might want to pursue this, because I had no idea what I was going to do with an English degree. So when I graduated, I moved to New York and ended up getting a job through a friend of the family in a documentary house. And they did industrials, small documentaries, government-sponsored films. And I was supposed to sit in the front, at the front desk and greet people when they came in. But I conveniently found myself answering the phone in the editing room, because that's the only thing that they had there. And there were a couple of editors who were really happy to have me sort trims, 16 millimeter. And I was ecstatic because that was sort of the idea of being in a library and all this sense of order. So I started to get an idea of what it was. And that job was only for a limited amount of time. And I had just qualified for unemployment. So I was getting $80 a week and had found this wonderful apartment in New York for $162 a month, fifth floor walk up in what wasn't quite Chelsea then, and shared it, a studio, with a friend. So $80 a week, I was able to afford my apartment and do that thing, which unfortunately we all have done, is I started to work for free and to volunteer my services. And as an ex-president of the union and now still on the board, I don't like saying that, but I also do tell young people that you need to gain the skills in order to offer your services. And so at that time, the only way was to, you'd walk around and there were a couple of editing buildings and you had your resume and you dropped them off, and sometimes people called. But another lucky thing, my brother-in-law, having gone to NYU, he had become friends with Susan Morse, otherwise known as Sandy, who was Woody Allen's editor for 20 years. And she was just starting her career as an editor. She knew very quickly that she didn't want to spend years in the trenches as an assistant. And so her mentor was Ralph Rosenblum. And he got her a job doing a small documentary, and she hired me as her assistant. And I was working on 16 millimeter. We worked in a broom closet at Tadeo. they moved out, and she put in her Steenbeck, and there was a table, rewind table, a bench. And there were a couple of feature films that were there on the floor, and I just looked longingly at that 35 millimeter film compared to my 16 millimeter film. So we did that, and then Sandy ended up getting a job as the first assistant on the Warriors when it came to New York to shoot. And again, it was a very odd series of circumstances. She couldn't hire me right away because it was a film that was shooting in New York but was going back to LA. So for the second assistant, they hired a woman who had a union card in both places, which was highly unusual. This is 1978. Highly unusual.
And right. There were two separate unions back
correct.
Then.
Correct. And it was very easy to get into the union in New York. All you had to do was get a job on a union film and work for 30 days and you were allowed to join. So wow. They were shooting A and B camera, which was unusual at that time. And there was a lot of film and the editor did not have a tremendous amount of experience. And he immediately bumped Sandy up to become a second editor. So that was a dream wow. for her. And wow. so she hired me as the apprentice, baptism by fire. It was my second real job and I was working on a Hollywood feature in New York. And the organization of the film, it was being cut on a chem. Most films in New York were being cut on moviolas. And the way that people, you'll appreciate this, Larry, because it just, young people will not understand this. My Sandy had never worked on a feature on a flatbed. And so her thing was you sunk the dailies and then you coated them rather right. than break them down, rearrange them into cam rolls and then coating them. So right. And this was with the coding system AA1000, AA2000.
The old machines.
So we did that. We sunk the dailies. We would code them. I would break them down and rearrange them into cam rolls. So the only person who could find a piece of film and reconstitute it was me. I ended up being indispensable. For that.
Absolutely.
And they ended up bringing me to Los Angeles. The producers said to David, the editor, what do you need to get this movie done? Because they were trying to get it done quickly because there was another gang film called The Wanderers that was coming out. And David right. actually said to the producers, you have to bring Lisa to California. So they did. I probably didn't get per diem. I didn't get anything. I was 23 years old and I was going to Los Angeles for the very first time. I had never been to California. I carried the line script on the plane and was busy trying to organize it. Paul Hager pulled me into his office and said, you have to promise to not to try to get into the union. I went, The second editor in California, a man named Freeman Davies, called the union every week and found out about the availability list. And at one point, the availability list went down to 5 people and they said, okay, you can bring your person in. So I got into the New York local and the LA local on one film, sort of achieved the impossible because it was so difficult to get into the LA local at that time. I mean, it was so difficult.
Wow. And you were born under a lucky star, girl. That's amazing. I mean, that just didn't happen back in those days.
That was my first film. I lived, ate, breathed, died it. And actually, occasionally, Walter Hill and I still exchange emails. And there was a road race in New York recently called the Warriors, and it went from the Bronx down to Coney Island. So I sent him the article, and we keep saying every time I went to, there was a retrospective of Walter's work at the Arrow a few years ago. I went to the screening. James Remar, who played Ajax, was there. I got a photo of everybody. It's just, you know, who knew we were working on a classic?
Wow. Yeah. And to be able to get in the union on that and, you know, one of your first films, really exciting stuff. But, you know, when you talked about walking into the editing room that first time and seeing those trims and stuff, you know, I remember just the feeling of excitement, you know, just like, this is such a different thing than I've ever seen. And what are these people doing at these machines? And it's like, you know, if you have that excitement when you walk into one of those rooms, you know that you might be destined to, you know, do something in this craft. Because if you don't get that, you're definitely, you know, it's a pretty good indicator that this ain't for you. But you know, I don't know what it is. It's that combination of machinery and creativity, the pictures and the gears that kind of really, you know, sparked my excitement about film editing.
Uh-huh. I agree with you. I tell people, you know quite quickly whether or not you can handle being in an editing room, because it, you know, a lot of people just need sort of more the excitement of the set. You have to, because otherwise it's really stifling. I was kind of like a duck to water, especially in terms of the organization. Just kind of, I could see the forest for the trees, the big picture. That's something that oftentimes you find as an editor, you try to pass down that whole experience to an assistant, and sometimes they can't. They get caught in the minutiae and they can't see the big picture and the process. And that's one of the most wonderful lessons I've learned. It's a process. It's from one of the things, especially when you're a young editor and you'll spend an hour on a cut, just or maybe more. It's like, I need to edit here. It needs to be right here. And when you're cutting on a chem, it's like, you know, and you're cutting on film, it's like, as it goes through the machine, and you sit and you think about it because you're trying to figure out, you don't want to make too many splices. Obviously electronically it's much better, but I've now realized, and this is, it can't be right there. It has to be before or after. And that's part of the process. It will all come out in the end. It's another thing, looking at dailies. I know there's some editors who look at every single piece of film really minutely before they start cutting a film. I have, I tend to feel that what I really want to do, the most help I can be to the director is to cut the scene as quickly as possible and get it to them. So I read the script notes. I try to get to have a good relationship with script supervisor. I try to get them to talk to the director. I try to get the director to talk to the script supervisor, really give them an idea. Some are better than others. I say, write a note to me, you know, Lisa, this is what we need. This is what we meant by this. You know, I don't really care. I read the notes, and then I'll start with the circled takes, and I'll start at the last one and go through and just start putting it. The hardest part is always figuring out how to start the scene. You know, that's always like, how am I going to do this? What's the first shot? And then you just start going, and it's, the film starts talking to you and telling you where to go. I assure the director, by the end of the movie, we will have looked at every single frame many, many times over. And I really do know that and believe that, that you keep searching and you want to make sure you have the best take. But
I love hearing this, Lisa. I really do, because you know what? That is really my same approach.
Your process.
Because, I just want to put together a scene. I don't care. Obviously I'd like it to be as wonderful as possible, but I want to have something, a rough cut to spring off of, you know, and then I can start going through the material. But to put something together as quickly as possible is really important for me. And for a long time, I was very self-conscious. Well, I'm not really looking through every single take. You know, sometimes the first three or four takes are garbage anyway, you know, but I agree with you, and I find the value of having something, you know, just a structure to work off of, really, it kind of gives me, a deep breath and like, okay, this is going to work.
Right.
Now let's make it as good as possible and really, you know, plow through the material.
Right.
And explore, you know, the possibilities. So that's really neat. Let me ask you a question about your experience as an assistant, because, you know, like me, I mean, I spent 10 years as an assistant, an apprentice, on and off. You know, occasionally I would get a shot at an associate editor credit or what have you. I worked in sound for a while, as you know. How do you feel that experience informed your work as a film editor? Do you think that applied?
Massively so. Now, something that doesn't really happen in today's world, when I was an assistant, oftentimes the editor would have you in the room with them to find the trims that were in the bin. They would hand you a trim and you would put it So they didn't have to be bothered by it. Carol Littleton, whom I call my mentor, she liked to work in a solitary way. I would arrange a bin with her and put the code numbers on it. And, you know, she was willing to take a look at it. But my first editor, he wanted me in the room with him a lot. And so I could watch the thought process of how he, sometimes it, I couldn't necessarily do it during the first cut because we just didn't have enough labor and I was
busy. You were busy with dailies and stuff.
And then
yeah.
Reconstituting that old fashioned thing. And because of this cockamamie coding system, I was the only one who knew where film went. But when you're in the room with the editor, you silently watch and say, oh, I would add more. I would have more at the head, or I would have more at the tail, or I think this is the shot that they're going to go for, and you'd roll down in the reel. Because remember, you'd have to roll down if you're working on a chem to get it. Unlike a moviola, you had all the things
rolls
on the bench. A very sort of different process. But you and editors would hire assistants as much for their sensibility to be really in sync with them when they were cutting. So I got the tail end of that. With Carol, I often say I used to listen to the radio, and then a lot of times I would stop listening to the radio and I would listen to the rhythm of her cutting. And I would really see where she was in the scene and kind of incorporate it. I could just feel it, understand it. There are a lot of times, especially with dialogue scenes, I'll cut the sound and then plug in the picture because it really has to do with the rhythm of the language. And the picture almost doesn't matter. It always matters, but, you know, so there are so many different ways to doing it. And also the other big thing is I had the opportunity to go to a lab and watch dailies. So we had maybe, you know, if you had an hour and a half, that was a lot. You know, I mean, you really didn't have many dailies in those days because people shooting on film, they really had to think about things. That changed later on. People would do it almost like now, keep rolling. And being with the director and the DP and the editor, the art director, the makeup people, hearing everybody talk about what was going on, you would, on my first film, I sat in between I sat next to the director because the editor did not want to take notes himself. So I would be there taking notes about the dailies. So, you know, I became very aware of, I like this take over that take and the reason why. And you start to learn a language. You really have to, because that's one of the things when you start to talk to a director, to be articulate about why you like something over one take over another, a cut over another, how it makes you feel, what it is. You really have to learn how to communicate in a way that's going to really express your opinion.
Clearly.
So going to a lab and sitting and watching dailies, as much as I hated it at the end of the day, you're just tired. I can't remember if we got paid for it or not. But you just did it because that's what it is. And then they started having dailies at lunchtime. That was never done before. Now you don't have dailies at all.
Nobody watches dailies anymore. Yeah, it's strange. I mean, and you can't because, you know, you can't sit through 5 hours of dailies. What I was starting to say was, you know, it's become a real problem that because we shoot digitally and there's no processing and there's no stock costs, they never turn off the camera. And it's really, you know, in my opinion, caused a real, you know, lack of discipline on the set. Now, from their perspective, a lot of time the actors, they don't want to cut because it breaks the thread for them. So, you know, I get it. But it really makes our job much more labor intensive, requiring bigger teams of assistants. And, you know, a lot of times from what I, you know, had experienced, the studios weren't really kind of getting it at first. You know, they were like, well, you know, why do you need all these extra people? And I'm like, well, because they shot 200 hours of dailies, you know, and that was unheard of, you know, back in the day. But let me ask you a question about...
We used to do it in film, and Heaven's Gate was the first film that had over a million printed feet of film, although now Apocalypse probably did.
You know, yes, Apocalypse did.
Those films that were the horror stories that all the assistants in town knew about.
But Apocalypse took 3 years to shoot a million feet of film, you know?
Yes.
So
4 years.
I mean... Right, exactly. So, I mean, you know, you're dealing with a completely different animal. I mean, again, this film, the last film I did for Netflix, had 200 hours of dailies. It was shot in, you know, it was shot in 50 days, 55 days. So, it's a whole different animal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, somewhat along those lines, I wanted to ask you, you know, you were talking about how we used to be in the room with the editor. Mm-hmm. How do assistants sort of learn the craft these days? I mean, I think that we're much more siloed in general because of, you know, digital editing, you know, and assistants are, you know, sort of saddled with even more metadata management tasks. That's certainly something that we, you know, teach in our class.
Mm-hmm.
How do assistants, you know, sort of get that experience? I mean, is it just because it's digital, you can just give them a scene to cut? I mean, how do you handle it these days?
You know, it differs on different films. I remember at the end of Pitch Perfect, I had two assistants and an apprentice. I don't think I did that. And we were getting towards the end, and it was a musical, and there was a lot of film, and there was, I'm pretty good at keeping up to camera, but this was just getting challenging at the end. And at the end, I was like, let's all start cutting. Whatever's available, we're all going to cut. And it was really fun. Some of the stuff was garbage. Some of the stuff was good. Chris McCaleb, who's going on to incredible fame, you know, and success with Breaking Bad, and that whole team, was one of my people who was brought on. He was brought on because we had a technical issue and they couldn't figure out how to do a playback code, and he came in to trick the Avid. It was great. We ended up with, and then I had an assistant, Don Broida, who now directs commercials, but he was an assistant of mine on and off for 9 years. And we had the wonderful opportunity. He started out as my apprentice on In Her Shoes on film. I didn't realize until late in the game he was finishing up college, going to college full time. This was when but he was doing stuff online and working full time. And, and then when I remember he became my first assistant when I did a pretty low budget film and he had a little more experience. And again, I felt like it was going to be a good match and I gave him stuff to cut. He did a great job. Philip Bartel, I just had the wonderful opportunity of having lunch with him recently. He's doing a Disney film, and Gina Blyer. Give people stuff to do. And Gina, I remember it was on film, and I remember Gina did one of those things where every other frame around some of the cuts was a cut mark. You just kind of say, here, go to it. And then I bring them in and we talk about it and I ask them to make changes. Every once in a while, it's a real bust, and I'll just take it back and say, you know what, I think I'm going to do this, and then you can look at what I did versus what you did, and that'll be the learning experience.
Right. So, well, that's great, but it seems what you're saying is, and I think this is a really good thing for people to know, is you have to be a little more proactive. It's nice if you'll work with an editor who will be proactive and offer you things to cut, but it's also probably a good idea if you sort of, you know, elegantly, you know, let your intentions be known, because that system is no longer, you know, available, where we were able to sit behind, you know, the editor and really kind of absorb in that almost, you know, unspoken way, you know, how to do our craft. Well, that's really great. You know, it's really great to know that you offer people the opportunity to cut, and because I think it's really like the only way to, you know, to get your
chops. So if there are times when it doesn't quite work out that way, but I tell people, you know, on your own time, if there's nothing to do, please feel free. You can, you know, there are dailies, practice, play.
Yeah.
Do it your way and then see, you know, don't look at what I did and see the way that you would do it. We can talk about it.
And it's digital, so there's no splice marks.
It's
wonderful in that respect. Hey, listen, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, and I know that, you know, before when we talked earlier, you know, you described yourself as not really that technical of a person, but, you know, I kind of, and we spoke about this, I kind of feel that, you know, you're short selling yourself, because if you're a film editor, you're probably more technical than the average person anyway. But I wanted to ask, you know, how does you not being a technical sort of oriented editor, like manifest in the cutting room? I mean, is it just because, you know, at a certain point, I kind of stopped doing all of the technical stuff also, and I really kind of just focused on the cutting. I mean, is it basically the same thing? I mean, do you just kind of like let your assistants kind of do all the, you know, the plumbing and, you know, obviously the metadata management?
I always wanted to make sure that I never was asked to work without an assistant. So I actually don't know how to get anything into a machine or out of a machine. So I don't know how to get them from the raw stock in, and I don't know how to do an output. I'm not going to say I'm, you know, proud of that, but that's the deal.
But that's not your job. I mean, and that's, you know, something that...
I'm technical in that I, you know, when I start a project, I remember assistants would say, what version of Avid do you want to be on? And I was like, I don't care. Whatever you want is fine. You're the one that has to deal with it much more than I do. If there's something that is lost from a previous version, you'll tell me how to do it. Somebody will tell me what to do. If something goes wrong, I often will, like if a message comes up, I always forget, what am I supposed to do? So now, I send a photo of it because I have this cutting room, which is kind of far away from where my assistants are. So I'll take a picture and I say, what am I supposed to press? Or say, can you come here, please? So I just don't, I cut the picture. I will cut sound. I'm a really good dialogue editor. I am very, very good at filling tracks. I hate doing it. A lot of times I find that people are not as persnickety about it as I am. So I will do that kind of thing. As I learned how to, when I got the job Pete's Dragon, my young director asked me if I would be willing to do it on Premiere. And this was, I guess, 7 years ago. And Premiere was really not ready to do a big Hollywood, you know, studio feature. And right. I did research about it. I really did. And I said to him, you know, it's not quite there, but if we ever do another project, I promise I'd be happy to learn Premiere. And lo and behold, we did another project together. So Adobe was quite wonderful. They provided me with a tutor and I was pretty comfortable by the time I started. And I got an assistant who was very versed. He's actually, he learned on Premiere. And so he quite knowledgeable. And so for the first couple of weeks, it was the same thing when I first learned the Avid. For the first couple of weeks, they have to babysit you a little bit more. But then you're fine. You know, once you know the JKLs, you know, forward, stop, reverse, you're okay. When I learned, it was forcing. Premiere is getting better with trim mode. That's probably one of the biggest differences. I use trim mode a lot. A lot. My director, who is now a member of the Editors Guild, is cutting on this movie. He's been making, directing, and editing films since he was around 8. So it made sense. And it's really funny because he'll get up to like 10 V layers. He like spreads out all over. We have to call it de-Davidifying it. We have to bring it back in. Because he doesn't actually really know how to use trim mode. And
right. So they stack the cuts.
Make cuts. We were having this conversation with my, he had gone into a reel and my assistants, we didn't know if he had done anything. And I said, well, he must not have done anything because there's not any cut in the music. There were cuts in other tracks, but there's no cut in the music. And we're having this interchange texting back and forth. And then David finally piped in and said, he does the rolling edits. And so the music just rolled and it doesn't cut. So it was one of the funnier things that was, I was like, could you please just cut next time? Then we'll know that you've been into a reel. He's like, I'll try. But you know, everybody's got a different way of working. So, when I learned, I actually created my own keyboard. I don't have an Avid keyboard. I don't have the Premiere keyboard. My tutor recommended that there was a better in between. And so I got a gaming keyboard and I have it all color coded and it's pretty funny.
Cool.
And so it was, and then after I finished my Premiere show, I went back to an Avid show and I was like, oh my God, am I going to know how to do that? It was like riding a bicycle. And then my next show was a Premiere show. Am I going to know how to do it? But it was fine. So.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. I mean, so are there things that you love about Premiere that, you know, you feel are missing in Avid, or are things that you hate about Premiere that you wish it had? I mean, give me some, like, you know, some of your...
They've come... When I first did Old Man and the Gun, the first time I went on Premiere, I was like this grid system of the tiles.
Right.
Fourth side, I was like, this has got to go. You have got to change this. You have got to change this. Alan Bell apparently was an advisor for them. He had told them that. It was every Avid editor who came in, you've got to change it. I think I complained the loudest, though, and the longest. And they...
In bin view.
So that you can move the tiles, because I group my tiles. I have them touching, like old masters. And then,
absolutely.
You know, it's a visual representation.
Absolutely. Yes.
How I want to cut the scene. And it's not just in alphabetical order. It's the wide shots. It's the way, because I started on a chem, it's the wide shots first, and then you change directions and then you go to the tighter shots or you keep it all on one character.
Yes. I mean, I do the same thing. I organize my bins in chem roll order,
you know,
and then I can look at it and it just like makes sense. But in the grid view, the way it's designed by a software engineer, it just looks like a bunch of pictures.
Oh my God. I did one film like that, but I hated it. I mean, I truly hated it. They heard from me a lot. They changed.
This is good.
Trim mode is getting better. The rollers don't stick the way that they do in Avid. I also use a pen and a tablet, so they don't stick with that. I now have a mouse because they stick much more when you use the mouse. There's a wonderful feature on Avid that if you go into trim mode and then go out, you can press... If I'm go back on an Avid, I'll have a muscle memory, a couple of the things, and all the rollers will go back on. So if you have 12 rollers will go back on. When you are working on a big feature, Adobe will create features for you. So we now have that feature.
Nice.
So that was a really big deal. I like there's an intuitiveness with Premiere with moving your shots that's probably comes more from Final Cut. I love the snapping at the beginning and end of cuts. There are probably things I miss Premiere when I'm not on it, but I miss Avid when I'm not on it also. I really like both of them. I'm sure at some point I'll end up having to learn Resolve. Who knows?
We'll see. Maybe.
Be the next
one. Well, you know, you bring up good points that both pieces of software have a lot to learn from each other.
Right.
And, you know, I do think that Avid has kind of, you know, brought on some of the, you know, segment mode, which is, you know, a very Mac interface like thing, which is just, you know, sort of organic in Premiere, you know, just dropping shots in and things like that.
Right.
But you know, you're right. And I think that it's just good for editors to have two robust, or as many as possible, really, but two, or, you know, Resolve would be three, Final Cut would be four, robust editing tools,
mm-hmm.
You know, to keep the marketplace healthy and competitive. So it's a good thing, and it's exciting that you're doing such a massive film, in Premiere. I'm glad that you like it. I actually do quite a bit of cutting in it myself nowadays, and I like it also. But my timelines don't look like any of these timelines that you see. Sometimes they post them on Instagram or something like that. There are these massive, 80 layer, you know, it's like, I like my picture to all be
I tell my visual effects people, I'm only going to have five layers. That's it. And we use six and seven to bring in new shots, and then we bring them down. I
pull them down.
The other ones, obviously, with sound, it's easy, especially when you're first, if you're in a big action movie, to easily have 16, 20 things. I try to minimize it. Right now, we're actually carrying, we did have our first temp dub, so we're carrying the mix, so we have fewer
tracks,
audio tracks. And I love and I can't remember if you can do this in Avid. I love being able to go hover and go into full frame of your timeline and then have it small.
Hey, let me ask you something. In terms of like getting into the business these days, what advice do you have, let's say for newer people who aspire to become film editors? What's your sort of, sage advice?
Well, for somebody in editorial, it's generally production assistants that you're giving this, PAs you're giving this advice to. And we get pigeonholed, especially at the beginning of our career. I know that getting in the union, sometimes reality is a really good way to get in. And there is definitely more movement between television, limited series, and films. But if you really want to work in features, which is not the best place to be working these days because there are far fewer of them than limited series and various things, really go after that. If you're going to be a PA, those are the people that you're going to meet. And those are the people, other assistants are where you're going to ultimately get your first job. And there's that unfortunate thing that they have to go and work non-union in order to get their days to get in. But, and then there are a lot of people right now who really are committed to television, and that's, so go for that. So I say go for the area that you want the most and meet as many people as you can. If you're an assistant, that's where you're going to find your, try to create as many relationships with fellow assistants because that's the network who's going to help you. They're going to hear about a job. They're going to recommend you for a job. I go to my assistant. If a friend of mine comes and says, I need an assistant, I go to my assistant and says, do you know of anybody? Because I don't know anybody. I just know my assistants. So it's building that network, maintaining your network. And there's a way to do it where you're not in somebody's face. But it's so easy to drop a line to somebody. And you have to put yourself forward. As you mentioned before, you say to your editor when you're an assistant, and I find that a lot of my assistants, when I'm interviewing them, they do say, do you allow your assistants to cut? And I'm always happy when they ask that question, because I like to talk about the film. When I work with, we generally always have lunch together. We watch the film together. I talk about it. I talk about the problems, talk about the politics, try to, at this point, it's trying to pass on any kind of knowledge that I have. And so much of our job is political. So when they're about to do something, I go, no, no, that's not really the person you should be talking to. And that's not the way to present it. You have to think about it this way. And I've made many mistakes along the way. I still continue to make mistakes, but it's all the process. And that's the one thing that, and I am not the most patient person, but editing and finishing a film, it's a process. And it teaches you life's lessons.
I agree. Yeah. And if you try to rush it, you're going to find yourself unhappy.
Right.
You know, if I found earlier on in my career, I would always want to be doing things faster and sort of forcing the process. And I would find myself, you know, miserable, because it just doesn't work that way. You kind of really gotta, be in the moment, be in the zone, really watch the performances, really, you know, absorb the material to, I mean, we all get under the gun and you got to slam things out every once in a while. But, you know, as an overall rule, yeah, that's really good advice. Well, listen, Lisa, thank you so much for speaking with us today. It's so nice to see you. And I wish you the greatest success with Peter Pan and Wendy. I'm sure it's going to be a fun movie. And I hope to be talking to you soon. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.